Beyond the darkness, beyond the human evolution, is Khan, a genetically superior tyrant. Exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round Perdition's flames before I give him up. There she is!
Against their shields.
The base is starboard.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me. Marooned for all eternity. Buried alive.
At the end of the universe lies the beginning of vengeance. Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. Joining me this week to talk about a classic, a genuine classic, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, is my pal and my editor from the 13thdimension.com. He's returning to the show, Dan Greenfield. Dan, welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Great to be here.
Yes, this is very exciting. We're here to talk about Star Trek II because, of course, the new Star Trek film, Star Trek Beyond, is just a couple of days away. So Dan thought we thought it would be fun to kind of go back and talk about one of the classic Star Trek movies. And there is no way I'm going to talk about the motion picture. So we're starting with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, 1982, of course, starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, and Ricardo Montalban as Khan, Noonien Singh, directed by Nicholas Meyer and produced by Harve Bennett, the savior of the Star Trek franchise. Dan, what makes this movie so darn good?
Everything. It is. It's
okay. Well, we're done. Anyway, it's been nice.
That's so true. It's so good, and it keeps getting. And I think, you know, I think that part of it is it actually, I think, gets better with age, because it gets better as you get older. I the more I watch it, and the older I get, the more I identify with the characters beyond just the obvious great action and characterization. But the whole thing is like a tribute to middle age. And there's such the theme throughout the story about whether you're on a starship or you're sitting in an office, you can put yourself in the middle of this action in terms of the characterization and the way they react to each other, the benefits of loyalty, your sense of experience, the roads taken and the roads not taken. There are so many things going on in this movie beyond the action right in front of you, which in and of itself is fantastic. From the opening sequence on the Kobayashi Maru, and within 5 minutes, we're already getting the characterization we didn't get in the first Star Trek movie. You feel like you are back on the Enterprise, even though it's only a training,
simulation.
A simulation. But you feel like you are right back there. It's familiar, and yet it's new, with the new uniforms, with a new, ostensibly a new commander, with Savick in the captain's chair. I find this movie to be so exciting and so enlightening that even now, and I've been watching it again a lot recently, I'm finding new things about it that I didn't even catch the last time I'd seen it. Little glimpses, we'll get into the details as we go along, But really what I find about this movie is its humanity, is that it as far as any other science fiction movie, I think it just comes out the best because it captures everything you want. There's the hopefulness, there's excitement, there's great special effects, great story. There you go.
Well, yeah, pretty much it. Yeah, I mean, there is so many things to talk about in this film. I mean, first of all, Nicholas Meyer and Harve Bennett, they took over the franchise. I mean, the franchise was handed to Harve Bennett, who was a TV guy, because the Paramount, you know, while they made money on the first film, they spent like $40 million in 1979 money, which was a fortune. And even though the first film made money, they thought it was such a debacle that they said, okay, we're going to hand the franchise over to a TV guy, and that way he's going to keep money tight and he's going to keep the production in line. And he came to it with no particular affection for Star Trek,
no.
Which is amazing because nowadays, you know, it seems to be for a lot of nerds, the benchmark is he's got to be a fan of the franchise. Got to be a fan. And that isn't always the case. You know, Harve Bennett basically sat down and watched all the Star Trek episodes on the Paramount lot, which sounds like a great couple of days to me. I heard that in a book, and I'm like, that sounds like a fun way to spend a couple of days is to sit in a Paramount screening booth and just, you know, with your hand up going, okay, run the next one. And he watched all the episodes, and he came away with the idea that a third of them were pretty bad, a third of them were pretty good, and a third of them were terrific. And one of the ones he thought was terrific was Space Seed, which – and he was right. It is one of the best episodes. And he saw how it ends. I mean, you literally have Spock say – it would be interesting to revisit the, you know, what the I forget the word he uses, but revisit the, you know, the flower that of the seed that you plant here today. And you're like, boom, right there. There's it. What do we do? And of course, then they go back to that and they, you know, we see that what has happened and that City Alpha 5, which Khan and his people were left on, was wrecked when City Alpha 6 exploded and threw the planet off its axis. And, of course, that leaves Khan with an unending need for vengeance for Captain Kirk. And it's just – that's such a wonderfully basic hook to draw your story on. But the thing that I am amazed at when I watch this movie over again is that both Harve Bennett and Nick Meyer did not disavow the events of the first film. They just ignore them.
Right.
You know, there is no need to say, well, this film ignores the continuity. It's just, we just don't talk about it. And right. If you want to, you can perfectly, and I'm sure people have, fit in that continuity just fine. Okay, they went and had that V'ger adventure. And then after that, Chekhov went off to work on the Reliant. And Spock took over the command. And Kirk got promoted to Admiral. And but at the same time, it just says we're going to ignore all that stuff because that stuff was bad. We're going to get rid of the gray jammies. We're getting rid of all the think pieces. All the characters are going to know each other. I mean, you mentioned the Kobayashi Maru. That is such a great idea to add to the Star Trek universe. Yeah. And it makes total sense that they would put these captains through this. You put them through this no-win scenario as a test to see how you handle stressful situations like that. I mean, it makes total sense. And it is one of the great openings. In terms of feigning left and going right, is that you think, wow, the Enterprise has been taken over by a new crew. Wait a minute, they're all dying. What's going on here? And then, of course, it gives Captain Kirk one of the great entrances in movie history. I mean, of that opener up, and then the shadows are behind him, and you just see that silhouette. It's such a perfect opening.
But it's also what's great about the opening and what we find out, you know, in short order, is that the only person to beat the Kobayashi Maru is Captain Kirk. And which, again, is more shorthand for someone coming into the movie cold. It's an intriguing question for someone who's familiar with the characters. It's great shorthand to remind you of why he was so great. It's all it is, it's like a trigger to remember that this guy is not just any captain. He's somebody special. He's a special kind of leader. He's a man of action. And that you get this sense that whatever he did was probably kind of shady, which also fits into his personality. So, and all through the movie, you get those moments where if you're not familiar, and here's the funny thing, and I've written this a number of times when I've done stuff about Star Trek at 13th Dimension. And this year we've been doing a weekly celebration called Trek Tuesdays. And this is going to be part of this podcast and some columns that you've written for as part of your regular column, Real Retro Cinema. We're doing Star Trek Movie Week. And then in the fall, we're going to do a regular Star Trek week. But one of the things that has been a constant theme that I've written about is that I came to Star Trek late. I actually didn't watch it as a kid. Like, a lot of kids grew up with it, and it was, you know, they would watch it with on TV. My dad watched it. It used to bore me. Couldn't tell you why. It just never really sang to me. But I did see, I think the first movie I actually saw in the theater was Number 3. So I kind of, you can get the sense that I kind of, everything started to build backwards. When I was around 19 was when I completely fell in love with the show. And at that point forward, I've been a fan ever since. And so I came to it late, but it's still been a very long time because I'm now approaching 50. So we're talking, you know, 30 years of watching the show and watching the movies. So I do have that kind of co-experience of finding it new through the movies and finding it intriguing and finding it interesting. And yet also there's so much payoff there for longtime fans. And the whole Kobayashi Maru really, really plays with that. And also that sense of, you know, when you have this young commander who's clearly capable because Spock wouldn't have her in the chair and he clearly treats her with respect. But she asks him, you know, what did you do? I don't think this was fair. And he's giving her what is really a very hypocritical speech about, oh, well, don't you understand that the captain, right, you know, we don't even know yet. Well, the captain has to face these things. And, you know, didn't you ever think that this is something you would ever have to think, you know, ever have to think about? And she's like, no, of course not. Says, well, now you have something to think about. But you get that sense of that tension between young and old and new, which I think even beyond the other installments makes this particular one rise above all the other Star Trek movies.
Yeah, I mean, it takes on the idea of aging head on, and this was something that Nicholas Meyer has talked about in the numerous pieces of interviews and writing he's done about the Trek movies, is that he felt that the first film was trying to hide the fact that the Star Trek crew had aged a decade since the series. And right. You know, he felt, but no, we're going to take it right on. And, you know, the next scene of Kirk is him at his super swinging bachelor pad.
Right.
I mean, that he has scored a lot of chicks in that place. There's no doubt about that in my mind.
It's all those guns on the wall.
Yeah, that is a macho pad, you wouldn't believe. But, I mean, you've got him and McCoy have a great scene together where he says, you know, you're kind of getting old a little, but you're letting yourself become old because you've been promoted out of, you know, you want to be out there, as he puts it, hopping galaxies. And when, you know, instead you're stuck behind a desk. And it really does. It takes that idea head on. And it says, yeah, this is our hero, but he's pushing 50 at this point, or he's maybe even older than that, I guess.
Early 50s, I think.
Early 50s. And he's out, he wants to be out doing a starship. And that is such a refreshing thing. And then right after that, of course, we are introduced to Dr. Carol Marcus, played by B.B. Besh, who's terrific in the role, and their son David, and you're kind of like, all right, this is a whole other scene, what's going on here? And then the big bomb drops, where they don't exactly say it, but anybody can piece it together, that David is the son of Captain Kirk. And this is, again, one of these things where, you know, Nicholas Meyer was just screwing with the Star Trek universe. Him and Hart Bennett were just like, that's it, we are going to rip it up. Because why not? I mean, Kirk has a son. That's news. You know, like, what a big... And again, you talk about with the Kobayashi Maru. I love the line that Carol Marcus has about, look, kiddo. James Kirk was many things, but he was never a Boy Scout. And it's like, so even though they are broken up, she still kind of has that glint in her eye when she thinks about her old lover, Captain Kirk.
But it makes sense, too, because he even says, you know, I stayed with later. I mean, I know we're jumping around the sequence of the film, and I'm fine with that if you are.
Yeah.
Even when she says, they have their conversation, and he says, I stayed away like you asked, which explained everything.
Yep.
It explained everything, and you didn't need to even have whatever happened and how did they meet. Because, when you point out that, you know, when you have someone watching all of the episodes together, and it's always been the joke, and Captain Kirk always got all the space women and always was having one night stands, it would only go to figure that at some point he'd get somebody pregnant.
Yep.
And it would go to figure that if this person was someone like this, if she decides to have the child, he's not really, it's going to only complicate things. So you don't even need to have all of the blanks filled in. It's great shorthand. It tells us, it gives her a sense of strength so that we know who she is. She's obviously someone who's accomplished, has made her choices. He's made his choices. there's some regret, but there's also the understanding that it couldn't have been any other way, which again goes to that theme of, you know, that sticking with who you are, but also understanding the payoffs to that, but also the debts you have to pay to kind of stay who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it does make total sense that she would want this boy in her life. If she wants to have the child, she'd be in his life, not chasing her father, chasing his father around and getting in all kinds of trouble. And right. It's in this scene that, of course, introduces the idea of the Genesis Project, which would sort of accidentally lead to a mini trilogy within the larger Star Trek framework. And to me, and we'll get into this maybe later on, that it is, to me, the best trilogy anybody's ever done, really, I think, in terms of the consistent quality. And, you know, just the fact that it's sort of buried amid the larger set of Star Trek films doesn't make it any less wonderful. I mean, these three films, to me, Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 are absolutely fantastic. And the idea that it all came out really from this idea of the Genesis Project. So at the same time, we have Chekhov and what's his name? The guy that's...
Terrell,
Paul Winfield. They go and are doing some research for the Genesis planet. They find this planet. Maybe they think they can use it. And that is where they discover Khan. And again, in terms of great intros, Khan has a wonderful intro. You're going into the movie. The movie's called Wrath of Khan, so you know what's coming. But nevertheless, the intro is nice and slow and creepy and weird. And the music is great. And just the idea that, you know, Khan has been harboring this anger for 20 years and no one has visited him. And who happens to drop in his lap but someone from the Enterprise?
What I love about it, and I know that you know, sticklers are always like, oh, well, Chekhov wasn't in that episode. I don't care.
He was down below. He was on another floor.
He was a crewman and he was doing whatever.
Yep.
And what I like is just his reaction, the Botany Bay, you know, the realization, Botany Bay, oh no, we have to get out of here. Yep. He knows it is going to go bad really fast if they don't get out. And of course, it's already too late by that time. So you're right. The build up to it. And then of course, in the same way that in the first time you see Kirk, you see him in silhouette with the light behind him. Here, you now see Khan and his crew with a sandstorm around them, and they've got those creepy masks, and you know that it's going to get really bad, but even then you don't even know how bad it's going to get, because when they confront him and you find out what's happened to Khan all this time, we get to the creatures.
Yeah. Oh, that I saw this movie when I was a kid. When I saw it in the theater, and that terrified me. Those little earworm things. Those are great little creatures. And you know, it's funny. Star Trek was never known for that, particularly because it didn't really have the budget to create little monsters like that. But I mean, it really is a wonderful little simple effect of these little puppet creatures that crawl into your ear and control your brain. I mean, it is, and the fact that one of them killed his wife, who of course we saw in Space Seed,
right?
You know, that's a wonderful detail that, you know, that they found a way to at least not harness these things, but capture a couple of them and use them when they need to. And it really is a horrifying, you know, idea. I mean, just and I love that little detail of when Khan sticks the pincers into the tank and he pulls the baby out of the back of the one, and then when he lets the pincers go. The little creature goes like, rah, 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 like it snarls at him. I'm like, oh, God, it's awful. Oh, it's so creepy.
It's so great. And the plunking sound it makes when it lands in the helmet.
Yeah.
So it gives that little extra weight to it that you just – everything about that is so creepy. And when the tongue flicks out, it works out so well. But also what I like and I read something recently where someone pointed this out, which I thought was – You get that right off the bat. You also get that kind of dichotomy where, you know, Kirk has gone on to become an admiral. Chekhov has done – everybody else's life has gone on where Khan's was absolutely ruined.
Yep.
And he has had nothing to think about for 15 years or 20 years or whatever it is but vengeance. It's single-minded, Ahab-like vengeance, whereas – he's even like, he's even like surprised in a way that Chekhov hasn't told Terrell about him.
Yeah.
Because he just assumes that this was such a huge thing to him, he didn't realize that there have been so many other adventures and they've gone off doing their thing. To him, that's even more offensive. That it's not just that it compounds the insult. What happened to him is that not only just that it happened, but that he was forgotten to the point where he was just a footnote in everybody else's career.
And he's so mad when he learns that Captain Kirk is now Admiral Kirk.
Yeah,
Admiral. And when he brings it up the second time, when he says, you never told you about how Admiral Kirk left us behind. Like, he's spitting it out. He's so mad.
He's so angry.
Ricardo Montalban is terrific in this movie. So, I mean, he's not subtle, but he's not trying to be. I mean, and that was something that they purposely did. They felt that the first film lacked a good villain. I mean, they thought it's a think piece. And so they were like, okay, we're going to flip the script and we're going to give this franchise a hissable, nasty, you know, balls out villain. And boy, they do, because he is really a fantastic villain. Now, I have seen some people suggest there was a little bit of confusion about Khan's people, about how they're all young and why they don't match the people that we see get carted off at the end of Spacey. But I always assumed that the people that, I mean, they're playing with the timeline a little, but I've always assumed that those people that we see are all young people. They are the children of the people that got stuck with Khan 20 years ago. I've always assumed that because everyone else is too young to have been on that mission 20 years ago.
It never occurred to me. I never even thought about it really one way or the other. Also, when it's the kind of things that you do think about and things that, you know, that strike you and things that don't. I mean, one thing to consider is that there's genetic enhancements. Mm. So who knows, you know, what worked for one and what didn't work for another. Maybe because Khan was out longer than the others. Maybe at the end, there's some confusion about how many of them were woken up at the end.
That's true.
You know, maybe some of them were still in hibernation. I don't know. But it's one of those things that doesn't even bother me.
No.
Because the only thing that matters is that he's lost his wife. And he's got these others, and even the one guy who I don't even think he has a name. I don't think he's even mentioned. He's just the guy who he talks to.
He's like the head, his first in command.
His main henchman.
Yeah.
And even he's like, look, you know, we got a good thing going. We have a starship.
We have a starship.
Yeah, we have escaped, and that's all we need. You've proved yourself. Let's get out of here. We don't need to do this. And Khan, and this is again the fatal flaw, his pride. He will have none of it. He will not rest until he has Kirk.
Yep. Yeah, that guy is utterly reasonable. You know, you've bested Captain Kirk. We've got a starship. Why don't we just go on? Nope. And we can't do that. So then eventually, of course, you know, Khan and Kirk run into one another. And this leads to another wonderful scene where we get another shot of showing, first of all, I'm jumping around. But like one of the things, again, I thought was lacking in the motion picture was because the characters had been separated for so long, they don't have that camaraderie. And here they have that. They have that instant camaraderie. And when Khan and Kirk are facing off one another, and Kirk pulls the lower shields bit.
Yes.
The prefix code.
Right.
That is such, again, such a wonderful, thoughtful little idea of here's our hero outthinking the bad guy. And just the idea that Khan – I keep saying Khan, Kirk. It's a Khan, Kirk. It's initials. It's so easy to mistake them. But when Kirk comes up with the idea, Spock knows what he's doing without having to say it. And he goes to Savick and he says, punch in the Reliance command console. And she's like, why are we doing this? And he's like, just do it. And then Spock just walks over and goes, prefix code. And he's like, it's the only we've got. I love that Spock is on the same page as Kirk on that. I love it's such a great moment.
It is, but it also, and again, it goes back to the point I was making earlier about that experience versus, because there's a twin payoff there. One you have earlier where she had criticized him for keeping his shields down. May I remind the Admiral, and Spock is like, you don't talk to Kirk that way. He knows the rules. Then they get disabled, and they get out of it, and they congratulate Kirk. And Kirk is like, hold on a second here. We just got lucky there. We only got lucky. You keep quoting regulations. Keep me on my toes. Remind me of the things I have forgotten. But then they flip the script, because then you're giving that you know, when that first comes up, you're giving that, okay, maybe Kirk has lost a step, and the issues that come with that. But then they flip it around. It's like now his experience takes over. He's back in his groove, and he says, "We need to do this." Spock reads his mind because Spock does know him so well, like you point out. And she's now confused. She may know regulation, but she has no experience. And now you see that come into play, and now Kirk starts to get the upper hand. It also happens a second time later on before they go into, and again, I know we're jumping around, very similarly when they're heading into the Mutara Nebula.
Right.
Where they're back from Regula One, they're back on the ship, and she's sitting down, and he's like, all right, let's go into the Nebula. And she's like, well, that's going to be a real problem for us because this is, the sensors aren't going to work and yada, yada, yada. All Kirk does is glance up at Spock, and Spock just turns to her and says, sauce for the goose.
Yeah.
Kirk, he just looks at them. And I only noticed that when I watched it again the other day. I never even caught the glance that it was, again, that unspoken communication between the two of them, that they knew exactly what they were doing. Even if it was going to weaken them, they knew it was going to weaken the other guys enough that they would keep the upper hand.
Yeah. Yeah, the rapport that Shatner and Nimoy have, which again comes from the fact that they've been working together and have been friends for 20 plus years at this point, is one of those things that you can't replicate. It's either got to be there or it isn't.
Right.
And there's another scene later on where after they go down to the Genesis planet, of course they run into Dr. Marcuses, and there's a great moment there where David lunges and ends up getting one of his friends killed.
Right,
because the guy Terrell shoots him and whatever, and I'm like, that's he's Kirk's son, all right, because he's just sort of careless. Yeah. But I mean, later on when they beam Dr. Marcus and Dr. Marcus back up to the ship, and you hear Kirk say, "You know, Mr. Spock," and she says, "Of course, hello, Mr. Spock," and she says, "Oh, I don't think he says anything." But again, I love that little detail that at some point over the years, Spock and Dr. Marcus have met one another.
Right.
That's an adventure we didn't see.
Right.
But I love that, just that little detail, and I just think it makes the universe feel so lived in that these people have gone, again, like you said, poor Khan is stuck in place, but the rest of them have gone on and done these things.
Right.
But I don't want to skip the whole scene down on the Genesis planet, because then that's another sequence of where Khan and Spock contrive this thing basically right in front of us. But when I first saw the movie, the first time I saw it, I didn't catch it when they're talking over the communications and Spock is saying, if we go by Savick and we follow the book, hours will seem like days. And Kirk just goes, got it. What do you have to tell me? And then you realize at that point, Spock is giving code to Kirk. And I love the idea that in a movie, all the information we need to solve the mystery is right in front of us, but we can't see it.
Right.
It's so well layered that we don't see it, because the first time I remember seeing this movie and the first time that came up and Kirk says, okay, we've basically been here enough, and he pops open his communicator and talks to Spock, I was like, oh my God, that's so perfect. Is that they've been laying in wait all this time, and it was all right in front of us. And then there's that great cut right back to DeForest Kelly, and he just has a smile on his face.
Yes.
Because he wasn't in on it, but he knew it. He was like, oh, of course Spock and Kirk have a backup plan.
But it's also the classic Kirk devil may care way he does it. He just flips it open and he bites into the apple, and he goes, I don't like to lose.
Crunch.
And that is such a fuck yeah moment when that happens. You're just like, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't care how many times I've seen it coming, it doesn't matter. Every time I feel like cheering, because I know, again, this is Kirk at his best, because with all the jokes about Kirk Fu and the fight scenes and all, it's that craftiness. It's always thinking one step ahead. And again, the others being able to communicate without being able to communicate. And again, it also plays the scenes also, again, not to put too fine a point on it, but I have found, I think maybe it's because of my own, the fact that I'm approaching 50, I do tend to look at this in a different way than I did when I was watching it at 25, is, again, like when he says if we went by the book like Savick is insulted.
Yeah.
She's put off by that. She's sort of like, well, hey, wait a minute. But it's, again, it's code, and it takes on a whole new meaning once they are, once we get that payoff.
Yeah. Oh, I have to mention too, just I'm thinking of it when McCoy and Kirk and Savick beam down to the Genesis planet and they're looking for everybody. First of all, that's a really well constructed scene. It's a really like a good horror beats in terms of the creepy music and they're looking at the guy. The guy is hanging there. But when they see that panel. And Kirk is trying to figure out how to open it, and he's pressing the buttons and doesn't do anything. And then he just punches it. Right. And I love that Savick kind of goes like, ugh, like she jumps a little. And I'm like, that's such a great Kirk thing where he's just like, boop, 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 damn it. He just smashes it.
It's so true. Actually, like just to jump back quickly, one thing that the exposition of telling us what Genesis is was brilliant. It was such a great way of when, you know, when they're on the ship and they find out what Genesis is, where you actually get that little, the little animated sequence to show us. It's such a great way of giving us everything we need to know about what this is. And then following it up with a classic again, you know, the first movie, it wasn't just that there was the lack of rapport. It was that nobody seemed like they wanted to be on the ship.
Right.
Except for Kirk, who was just kind of like itching to do it because he was dissatisfied and Spock didn't want to be there, but you have these three old friends again together, and they immediately fall into their old roles, where Spock is just thinking about this from a logical, rational standpoint. Bones is horrified. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just completely horrified by the whole idea, and Kirk is like, guys.
Yeah, I love that they have the time to have a classic Spock-McCoy philosophical argument. It really is. It proves that, you know, okay, these guys may be new to the series, but they know what made it good. They know what made it interesting, and they find the time to introduce these things. So then, of course, he said Kirk gets back on the Enterprise, and it's the final duel between him and Khan. And this is something people have pointed out over the years, in the fact that Shatner and Ricardo Montalban share no actual scenes together.
No.
Everything is done over a view screen. I never noticed that growing up. All the times I've watched this movie, it never bothered me. And if I want to do like a retro, you know, excuse for it, you just say, well, in the 23rd century, most people are going to live their lives on view screens.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about 95% of the people I know on Facebook, I am never going to meet. I'm never going to meet these people because that's the way the world is now through technology. So it doesn't bother me that Kirk and Khan never get an actual face-to-face meeting because it's like, well, that's just life in the 23rd century. Everything is done via computer.
Well,
and it never bothered me anyway when I was watching it.
Not only has it never bothered me, but I think that it actually plays to each character's strengths. And again, it plays, I think, a lot of the theme of the movie itself. Because this is not about a battle of physicality like you saw when they fought the first time.
Right.
This is a battle of wits. And that's what, ever since he gets the Reliant, the whole thing has been a chess match and a chase. There are parts of Balance of Terror in this movie with the, you know, basically, you know, one is the ship and one is the submarine, this kind of, you know, what can we see and what, you know, do we see them here or we're going to run below them or we're going to run above them and all of that. There are this sense of, you know, the Moby Dick, you know, with Khan's obsessive, you know, destructive obsessiveness. And so you have these different things that go on that, to me, just having it end up in a fist fight, unlike in Star Trek III, where you do get a payoff of a fight between Kirk and a Klingon.
Right.
You don't need that here. That's not what the movie is about. It's not about physicality. It's about experience. It's about being tactical. All the way through, Kirk is not tested physically. It's not about that. It's not what you see in other, like a superhero movie. It is all about his abilities to lead, command, and outthink his opponent. So it only goes to follow that they wouldn't have to meet.
Right. And of course, in the scene down on the Genesis planet, we do find out exactly how Spock, how Kirk fixed the Kobayashi Maru test, or how he passed it, which is a wonderful. I love McCoy when he says, "Lieutenant, you were looking at the only Starfleet captain," and he just wags his finger at Spock, and at Kirk. And I just love that that's a reveal that we find out that that's, of course, how we did it. You know,
and it's with an admiration.
Yes. You know, he loves it. Yeah.
It's not dismissive. It's like he had the guts. It wasn't just the the wherewithal, it was the guts to do what nobody else would do. It's he cheated. Yep. And that's always, that's Kirk.
Yeah, yeah. He realizes this test is not fair, so therefore I'm going to change the rules. It adds so much to the Kirk legend.
Yes.
Which is just remarkable. You know, it really is such wonderful, wonderful writing. So anyway, Kirk is back on the ship, and he has the final face-off with Khan, and Khan gets his final revenge in by setting off the Genesis torpedo and planning to explode it. And the Spock, of course, makes the calculation. The only way he's going to fix the Enterprise is to go down and to do it himself and sacrifice himself. This scene is the only moment that I think the film misses something, and it's very minor, and so it's barely. But I wish when the Enterprise takes off into warp speed, we had a shot of Khan seeing that. We don't get that. We think Khan dies thinking he's gotten the upper hand. And that's the only part that I wish – I just wish there was that shot – because when they do the prefix code, there's that great scene of Khan like, what?
Yeah,
when
the guy's like, their
shields are dropping. I wish there was a scene of Khan like watching the Enterprise just go poof and then knowing, damn it. But that's a very, very minor thing. It
never
really
bothered me. But I can see where – now that you point that out, I can see where it would. It doesn't bother me. It's just, again, the they got out of it. But even even as that's all going on, and my understanding, my recollection is that there had been rumors that Spock was going to die in this one, I think, going into it.
Right.
And which is, I think, also why the Kobayashi Maru scene at the beginning is such a nice feint, because Spock does die in that scene. And so I think that was a nice bit of misdirection. But even then, at the end here, while all that's going on, you're still not prepared for what comes next.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you have that wonderful moment. And I love during that whole sequence, Kirk does not notice that Spock is gone.
No.
That's great. And then he looks in the chair after McCoy says, you better get down here. And he looks and he sees the chair's empty. And you're like, oh, my Lord. And he runs down. And
he assumes it's Scotty who fixed it.
Right, right. Because he says Scotty.
Scott, Mr. Scott, a head warp factor, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And so he gets down there, and then, of course, that leads to, maybe the finest moment in the Star Trek movie franchise in terms of its power. The idea, metaphorically, that these two have been separated by who they are, and they're separated by that glass.
I don't think it's a maybe. I actually think it's the high point of the entire everything. Anything Star Trek has never been exceeded by that scene.
Yeah. It is amazingly powerful, and I love that Spock, who's always the most dignified character, is a little doddering. The way he bumps into the glass, and his skin is all kind of melted and stuff like that. It lays him like a little low, which is wonderful. And Nimoy is tremendous in this scene. I mean, as we all know, this was done because Nimoy wanted to get out of doing Star Trek. He really thought that Paramount was just going to ring this thing like the Jaws franchise. He was just going to ring it out every nickel they could. And he was like, kill me off, and they won't ask me again. And then it dawned on him after the film was completed, wow, this turned out really – maybe I shouldn't have died. This was a really good thing. And then, of course, they went back and rejiggered the ending a little so they could have that opening. But that final scene, of Kirk and Spock is so powerful. And I remember seeing it in the theater, and people just – you hear, like, sniffling. Mm-hmm. And then after they do the Vulcan hand gesture on the glass, and then Spock dies, and Kirk turns and just plops further down, like, sitting. And he just looks so desolate, and it is an amazing moment. It is so powerful.
There are a couple of things within that scene that always grab me. One is when, first off, they how brutal when Kirk runs in and they stop him from going in the chamber, because he will go in if no one was there to stop him.
Oh yeah,
gone right in. And when Scotty says to him, he's dead already.
Oof, that really hangs in the air.
Right there, it goes right into your chest. And you see him slump there. But when Spock is going to face his, as he made the point earlier in the movie, that he's your friend, you are my superior officer, and you're my friend. He's not going to face him slumped over. He stands up. His back is to him. He stands up. and he tugs his tunic down.
Yeah, that's right.
He's going to present himself with you know, like at attention.
Yeah.
And he turns, and as my son is always telling me, it's like whenever I see that scene, it's like get ready for the man tears. It's like that's it. You know, I'm a mess at that point. And his first question, ship out of danger. And just those, again, you're playing with all of the things that are exactly right. And even the fact that it's not even clear that they're making eye contact. It's not even clear that Spock can see him because he does bump into the glass. It does look like he might be looking over Kirk's shoulder. So he might not be able to see. But he's keeping it together for one last moment. And then you're right, that shrinking scene when finally, you know, Spock is, you know, slides down and Kirk slides down and he, the look of on his face of just he's lost everything.
Yeah.
He's won, but he's lost everything. And then to me, the that's followed up, if that's not the greatest scene in Star Trek history, to me, it's followed up of what I think is actually William Shatner's finest moment as an actor, comedic, you know, dramatic, whatever, scenery chewing, when he gives the eulogy, and it's not just the eulogy, it's that when he's explaining of all the souls I've met in the universe, you know, his was the most, and his voice catches, and he says, human. When he says that, it's like it just brings down the house. And then, of course, they play Amazing Grace, and then I'm done. I'm just done. It's all over.
It's one of the few I've found to be movie death scenes that I think have loses none of its power, even though you know what's coming, that he's resuscitated. A movie later, the scene is so well done that it doesn't, to me, I still get affected by it, even though I know this isn't permanent. One movie later, he's back. It doesn't matter. It just works. It still works really well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about it right now. It gets me filled with all of that emotion and that, you know, just talking about it and thinking about it. And it doesn't matter that it goes on from there. Because you could end the story there of these two men. You could end the story after the trilogy too, and we never needed to see them again.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. It's so well done in and of itself that the payoff is so strong, even, you know, 30 some odd years later.
Yeah, and so after one more scene with David, where David acknowledges that he is in fact Kirk's son, and they have sort of an awkward hug there. There's the final scene on the bridge of the Enterprise, where you know everybody gets a story arc, and Kirk gets the completion of his arc in this film is that he feels old in the beginning of the movie, and then at the end he's smiling, and McCoy says, "How do you feel, Jim?" And he says, "I feel young." And he's gone through this horrible experience, but he has changed. He's a changed person. He no longer feels like the old man. And so, you know, we've been delivered. We're delivered a new Captain Kirk than the one we got in the beginning of the film. And even though he's been through this terrible thing, he's in a better space. And then, of course, it ends with the famous crawl, Space the Final Frontier, read by Leonard Nimoy, which is a great touch.
Yes.
They do some slight kind of sound modification, so it sounds kind of sepulchral. You know, it's got that slight little filter to it. And, you know, it really is him just saying, and I think even Shatner says this in one of his books, where this is Spock saying, "Come get me." And we go to the end credits, and, you know, we're left with that wonderful, upbeat kind of space adventure music. And it's just, you know, you're watching, you go, boy, that was just, that was a hell of an adventure I was just on.
That's true. You know, you mentioned the music, too. We haven't even talked about the music because,
Horner, we should mention, is by James Horner.
I never liked the music in the first movie. And I know that they used that for the theme of the TV show, to my eternal consternation. I mean, it's fine. It always seems tinny and cold to me. It doesn't have the warmth. This music, on the other hand, is it's soaring. It does feel like you're, you know, it's not just you're a space adventure, but it's like a seafaring adventure.
Yep.
That they are on ships, and you feel the music sounds like wind in the sails and crashing waves, and the tension that it builds also in the battle scenes, and even when the Enterprise leaves space dock, the music that they use. A scene which also, by the way, they basically was a repeat of what we saw in the first movie, but it's so much more effective because it's like half the time.
Yeah, a lot shorter.
A lot better music.
Yeah. A lot shorter. A lot shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you really can trace the modern love of Star Trek to this film, because I think if this had been a flop, I think that probably would have been it for Star Trek.
It would have been a relic of a time. It would have been, oh, remember that old show? And then maybe they would try it again 15 years later, and people would say, why are they going back to that well? It didn't work the last time.
Yeah.
And I think that it's you're right. I think that this was the movie, and I can see where people would say, of course, that these guys saved Star Trek. And I think it's also interesting in the sense that, like, Nicholas Meyer had no love for the show. He wasn't really familiar with it. Sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. It worked here because he had just enough distance from it not to understand what made it work, and yet also enough that he wasn't so married to certain ideas that he didn't want to change things around. And when you crystallize that, it's magic. And I recently, just over the last few days, did watch 2, 3, and 4 in rapid succession over successive nights. And I love watching it with my kid, who's 17, because he loves these movies too, and he always has different perspectives on things, and we talk a lot about the various scenes. And what is interesting is to see it as the first chapter of a trilogy, and also to see it on its own. And on its own, it does work very well. As a trilogy, it's interesting to watch the ups and downs of the whole sequence of the three movies and what works and what doesn't. But if they had ended it after the fourth movie, I would have been completely satisfied. Not to knock. I actually don't mind the fifth one like a lot of people do. And the sixth one is perfectly fine. But if they'd ended it with number four or with number two, that's all I needed.
Yeah, they really – this movie ended up giving us a wonderful – I mean, they had all these story threads to follow, to pick up on in Star Trek III. And so it led to it's like, oh, well, this is going to be easy. We're just going to just continue this wonderful story that we've got. Yeah, this movie just holds up so, so well. I never get tired of watching it. I've seen it on the big screen a couple of times. It really is – it takes all the best elements of your characters. And we haven't even mentioned, like, Sulu and Uhura and Scotty. They all get great moments. I mean, poor Scotty, I guess, comes down with an STD at some point, which McCoy cures him up. Sure, leave, Admiral. Sure, leave. I mean, it really does – everybody gets, like, a really good moment. And except this is a Titanic sort of story. And it's amazing to think that this film was made for $11 million.
Crazy.
Now, I know that it's 1982 money, but you consider that the first film was made for $40 million.
Yeah.
This was made for $11 million. You can't make – like nowadays, you can't make an Anna Kendrick comedy.
No.
Like Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates is probably double that. And this is a sci-fi epic. And so Nicholas Meyer really had to cut corners. And yet we still got all new uniforms and new sets and all these wonderful things. And it's like
– the uniforms are great.
I
love the red uniforms because there's a warmth to them that again, it was all the visual cues, like we've been saying, the uniform, I'm glad you actually mentioned that because I would have kicked myself if we hadn't talked about them, is the uniforms are great. They look like military uniforms, but there's a warmth to the color that gives a sense of immediacy or intimacy that the first one lacked. Is that it? Not only was there a lot of the way the bridge was lit, which made it better for this one than it was in the first one, or even in the recent ones where people like call like the newer, I guess now the Kelvin timeline Star Trek. It looks like an Apple store. It feels like a ship, and yet it's not so far off that it felt like the living the Hilton hotel room that the Enterprise D felt like. It felt close and yet military and yet utilitarian and yet warm at the same time. The visual cues are really important in this movie also. The uniforms play into that as well. And just the fact that they've got little colored different collars, so you still have the throwback to the Star Trek of the different tunics. This, it looks really, really good and comfortable.
there's a lot of bit of business too with the opening up the vest and shutting the vest. Like, yes. There's a lot of that. Kirk does a lot of that. Like, I'm in my casual wear, my vest is open, right. And then I pin it up. Yeah, it's they do look vaguely nautical, which is the kind of the whole idea of the movie. But yeah, they are really quite attractive and much better than the little form fitting jammies that they had in the first film. And these are the uniforms they stick with.
Yeah,
all the way through to the final film, you know. So they obviously Meyer and his people really contributed quite a lot to the Star Trek universe, and it says something about how much people revere Nicholas Meyer that, you know, there was the news of the new Star Trek TV series, and people were kind of okay, maybe, and then they said, oh, Nicholas Meyer's gonna be involved. Oh, really? You know, like, it immediately kind of gave it that sense of like, well, man, I'm gonna watch this then. Nicholas Meyer's involved. This guy knows what he's doing. I mean, again, to make a movie of this scope for $11 million is really amazing. I know they cut corners here and there and they cribbed some shots, but I don't notice any of that stuff. And everything else looks really terrific. And you just delivered a wonderful story, and it really set Star Trek back on course. And, you know, it's just that it's just a wonderful, wonderful movie.
And the Reliant is a cool-looking ship to boot.
Yes, yeah, we get the other, yeah, we get the ship and stuff, so yeah, it's fantastic. So, is that going to do it for Star Trek II? Do we have anything else we want to say about Wrath of Khan before we wrap up?
No, I think it's great. I wish I had Ricardo Montalban's pecs.
Yeah, oh, he definitely, I guess, wanted to look good. That's a great, in the commentary, Nicholas Meyer does a commentary track, and he's really funny, and he talks about working with Ricardo Montalban, and apparently the first scene that Ricardo Montalban did, he was like at 11, you know, like his very first scene, he was like, ah, rah, rah. And he was like, and Meyer was kind of like, okay. And then he's like, how do I tell him? And so he apparently took him aside and said, Ricardo, I just want to give you some perspective here. If you're at your apex of rage now, you have nowhere to go. It's you know, so I think maybe you should be, because he's talking about the scenes with Chekhov, and right. He's like, I think maybe you should be like seething with rage, yes. but controlled. Yeah. And apparently, and he said, you know, he said to Ricardo Montalban, kind of shook his head a little and went, ah, I am being directed. That's what I want. And he was looking for that. Ricardo Montalban had not been in a movie in a long time, probably since like Planet of the Apes or something.
Right.
And so he didn't really know what he was doing. And he sort of he thought that was great. He was like, oh, great, I'm being told what I'm supposed to do. And of course, again, it's not a subtle performance, but he's a great killer villain, you know, and he's got the pecs and everything else and the, you know, the nice big mane of hair. He's fantastic. He's a wonderful villain. And, you know, it's a perfect through line from Space Seed. You see the same guy, the same arrogance. He's been laid low from decades of indifference and pain and suffering, but he's that same arrogant guy, except right. He's just completely focused on his vengeance. And again, after the kind of boring think piece of the first film, here you're given a classic tale of vengeance, and who doesn't want to watch that? And when it's as executed as well as this is, it just makes for a classic movie.
Well, if the Klingons are the ultimate, you know, adversaries as a group, or as an opponent, or a race, or a nationality, when you've got your, you know, of course it was an allegory for the Cold War at the time. Khan is the greatest villain, and yes. It's not because of the TV episode; it's because of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, we don't have to recommend this. Anybody who's listening to this has seen Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan. There isn't anybody, but nevertheless, we wanted to talk.
Yeah, anybody
about it.
Listening to this has seen it, but it just feels like it feels so good to celebrate it and to talk about it, especially now. You know, 50 years of Star Trek, and I have been so immersed in it this year, and rewatching things, and it's been an utter joy, and just nothing tops this one. Nothing tops this movie.
So Dan, where can people find you on the internet?
13thdimension.com, 13thdimension.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook. And again, I want to specifically mention every Tuesday from now until at least until September, and maybe even beyond, because I've got more material than I know what to do with right now. We're doing Trek Tuesdays, which has been nice because I had an opportunity to interview William Shatner. So you can find that at the website, George Takei, Nichelle Nichols. Plus, we've had a lot of guests, and like yourself, with the columns you're doing on the movies, on Real Retro Cinema, which is always a hit at the site, and I'm sure that people are going to be reading those this week as well.
Yes, I got to write something about Star Trek II and the other films for Real Retro Cinema, and I'm really enjoying it. I love writing those columns. So, excellent. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Rob, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, too.
All right, so everybody, if you want to follow the show, go to Twitter. It's Film and Water Pod, or you can leave a comment over on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. So until next week, that's a wrap.
It would be interesting, Captain, to return to that world in 100 years and learn what crop had sprung from the seed you planted today.
Yes, Mr. Spock. It would indeed.